Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to our subscribers and to everyone joining us today. I'm Anna Kuchmant. I'm a science reporter with the Dallas Morning News, and I'm joined by two COVID-19 experts today. We have Dr. Trish Pearl. She is Chief of Infectious Diseases at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Dr. Erin Carlson, who's Director of Graduate Programs at UT Arlington's College of Nursing and Health Innovation. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today and helping us make sense of this very uncertain time in the pandemic. Dr. Pearl, I'd like to start with you. I was wondering if you could just talk about the current state of the pandemic in North Texas.
So I'm happy to discuss this. So when we look at pandemics, we look at a lot of different types of information to determine what the state of affairs is. And some of that information is, you know, obvious to the public. Some of it is less obvious to the public. So when I look at all of that, what I can tell the audience is that all of our metrics really show that not only are things increasing, but it actually looks like some of the severity is increasing. So what are we seeing? We're seeing that the number of cases are going up. We're also seeing something called the percent positivity, which means the number of tests that are done that are positive. So what percentage of tests are positive? That can be an early indicator that you have more disease penetration into the area you're looking at. We're seeing increase in the number of visits in emergency rooms with symptoms that are suggestive of COVID. We're seeing hospitalizations, and then we're also seeing a lot and more significant increase in our ICU utilization. So all of those indicators are going up and suggest to us that we are not only in the middle of an increase, but the increase is going to continue for a while. There are other indicators that we look at that we may see downstream a little bit, so a little further on, such as deaths, which are more of a late indicator. What has changed a little bit and what is different about this wave is that we are seeing a much more dramatic increase in young people who are getting admitted. So those under the age of 49, and certainly pediatric admissions. So those are really very, very different than what we were seeing earlier. And then the other thing that we're seeing that's very different is in January, what took us almost 4 months to get up to that peak, we're actually probably going to get up in a month and a half or 2 months. So really a much more dramatic increase.
That's interesting. And I know that UT Southwestern puts out regular forecasts projecting the trajectory of the pandemic out by a few weeks. What is your team expecting to see this fall? You know, when do you expect that we might see a peak?
So first of all, I have to thank all my colleagues who really do the heavy lifting in all of this. And it's always an honor to represent their work. But what everyone needs to understand about modeling is they're models, and they're as accurate as the information that you put into them. And one of the things that's been very challenging with this is that the Delta variant has acted in a much different way than the previous variant. So we don't have a lot of historical information, and we're basing our models on information that have come out of other countries where they have different vaccination rates, different vaccination schedules. They have different implementation of what we call non-pharmacologic measures. So with all those caveats, we actually expect a peak of this probably in September. And if we follow what we've been seeing in other countries, it should be a much more narrow peak. So it'll be abruptly up and then abruptly down. And it won't be quite as rounded, if you will, when you look at the curve. And that's about as far as we've been able to go out. And what what is going to complicate this a lot is we do not know how much this will be complicated by other respiratory viruses. So, you know, in the fall, a lot of times we see flu, we see respiratory syncytial virus, we see all of these other things. And, you know, Dr. Carlson is probably in a better position to talk about this than I am, but, you know, that also will impact the healthcare system.
Thank you so much. Let me just remind anyone tuning in that we're happy to take your questions. You can just type them into the Q&A function. So keep those coming. I'll ask a couple of more and then I'll turn to your questions and put them to Drs. Carlson and Dr. Pearl. Dr. Carlson, is there anything else you'd like to add about the state of the pandemic in North Texas?
Not really, other than I just want to echo what Dr. Pearl said about there's always other unanticipated consequences to any kind of outbreak or pandemic. So we will be seeing other types of infections, other types of diseases as they come along, and all of those things affect the healthcare system too. And so we need to be mindful of protecting our healthcare system at this time, because it's not only about COVID, it's about everything else that will be coming through.
Thank you. And so I wanted to ask each of you how you've changed your behavior since cases started rising again in North Texas. In other words, are you still grocery shopping? Are you eating out? What are you doing about having friends over? Dr. Carlson, let me start with you.
Well, thank you for that question. And it's an honor to be here today and represent University of Texas at Arlington Public Health Programs. I think that how much our behaviors have changed likely depend on whether we fall into a category of people who is particularly vulnerable with regard to COVID, as far as how much those of us who are fully vaccinated changed after Delta came into the picture. So in some aspects, I think Delta has changed everything in the pandemic. In other ways, though, the same rules still apply. Before Delta, vaccines were significantly reducing the number of cases. They were preventing people from being infected, and vaccinated people who got infected were unlikely to infect others. They wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't be infected. They wouldn't be able to infect others. And that's still true, even with Delta, just to a somewhat lesser degree. So the game changer now is that some vaccinated people may transmit the virus, and some could be infectious, like people who aren't vaccinated are infectious. So previously, vaccination took vaccinated people out of the chain of transmission. Delta put them back into that chain to some extent, right? They're still far less infectious. They're contagious for a shorter period of time than those who are vaccinated. They'll transmit the virus to far fewer people, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, all that to say that people who are really at the mercy of others' vaccination status before, that is those who can't get vaccinated for medical reasons, a very small number of people, children under age 12, and those who are immunocompromised or on some immunosuppressive medication who may not have had the same effect from the vaccination, now they could get the virus from somebody who's vaccinated. And so the only way for a vaccinated person to be completely out of that chain of transmission is back to wearing a mask. So I think that's the key behavior change that has come about during the resurgence of Delta, is now those of us fully vaccinated should be wearing masks. And, you know, we have to keep in mind that a more transmissible pathogen, which is Delta, requires stronger defenses if we're going to continue to curb the spread. So we're back to those same non-pharmacologic interventions for addressing COVID transmission, for stopping COVID transmission. We're back to masking up, even if we've been vaccinated, to go to the grocery store, to do our Target run. Really, I'm back to masking up for anything indoors that's in public. And previously, after I was vaccinated, I wasn't doing that. I was going to the grocery store without my mask on because I'm vaccinated. I felt a little bulletproof. That's no longer the case. Also, the type of mask I'm wearing has changed. After I was vaccinated, when I did want to mask up just for, you know, appropriate protocol or out of an abundance of caution, I'd put my little cloth mask on and I felt pretty good about things. But now I'm back to wearing my N95. Or I'm back to wearing a nice cloth mask that has a filter pocket inside of it. I'm more conscious of the type of mask I'm wearing. I'm more conscious about who I'm around, who I meet up with, where we meet, how many of us meet. Going back to dining al fresco instead of dining inside the restaurant. I'm traveling less. I was back to traveling internationally for work after being fully vaccinated. Now we're scaling that back as well. So those are the kinds of things that have changed since Delta.
Thank you. Dr. Pearl, can you talk about that as well? How has your behavior changed since we started seeing this surge?
My behavior actually hasn't changed that much. I really never dropped my guard very much for a lot of different reasons. But one is that I work with people who are immunocompromised. And so I felt that as part of my responsibility to them, that I had to actually be extremely cautious. And I do have an immunocompromised daughter. And so, you know, for that reasons. And the other thing is that I recognize that we still had a lot of work to do in North Texas. We have a relatively low vaccination rate, and I couldn't count on people being vaccinated out there. So it, you know, that we are not like some areas of the country where you have 80 and 90% of people vaccinated. And so knowing that there are vaccine failures, et cetera, I just felt I needed to be careful. So my behavior didn't change a lot. I will, like Dr. Carlson, say that I was probably more mobile, but I was still masking and socially distancing. But now I agree with her. I mean, I certainly don't want to go to any kind of large events, and I wouldn't go to any kind of large events because I think the risk of having, you know, any kind of super spreading event is clearly there because this virus is about 100% more transmissible than the original virus and 60% more transmissible than the alpha variant. So, I mean, this is a highly, highly infectious virus. In addition to what Dr. Carlson was saying, we just know that it's infectious. And, you know, before, if I was ill with COVID, I would give it to two people on average. Now, with the Delta strain, I'm giving it to six. And each of those six people gives it to six more people. So it's really, the transmission is logarithmic compared to what we were dealing with in the early phases of the pandemic.
So since CDC guidelines on mask wearing and social distancing for vaccinated people have changed recently with the Delta variant, I wonder, Dr. Pearl, if you could just remind us, what are the current CDC guidelines, and is it safe for people to be dining out, and is it safe for vaccinated people to have their vaccinated friends over for dinner or for a party, you know?
Yeah, so I'm going to give a caveated answer to this, because I think, you know, what people have to understand is that CDC guidance is guidance. And what you have to do when you're looking at this is actually decide what risks you're willing to take and not willing to take. And so you may want to go and be much more aggressive than the CDC guidance has been, and that's fine. You know, it's absolutely fine if you have immunocompromised individuals or whatever. So the CDC basically is saying that you should be masking when you are in public with other individuals, especially when you do not know their vaccine status. But as Dr. Carlson said, what we're beginning to understand as we look at what we call transmission dynamics, you know, how this virus is transmitted, is that it is changing rapidly. And what she and I say today could be wrong tomorrow. We're getting information that quickly. And so right now, what we really are saying is, you know, absolutely, you should be wearing your mask when you're out in public, when you're around other individuals. And if you're in settings where you're not sure people are vaccinated, you should absolutely be doing it. And maybe you should be thinking about it if you know they're vaccinated. You know, you don't know who those people have been exposed to. And we're beginning to see that there are people who are asymptomatic with infection.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
I would like to add just one thing to that. I echo everything Dr. Pearl said. And one thing on the topic of folks who are immunocompromised, you know, and I'm included in that group, and we're an invisible disability. You can't see us. You can't look at a crowd and know who's vulnerable necessarily. And so people seem to think there's going to be like a neon sign. If they're around somebody, they have to be particularly careful around, but you don't know. And so it's important that we all take that into consideration, that at any given time, you're going to be around somebody who is vulnerable to severe illness should they contract COVID. So we all need to be mindful all the time of just taking universal precautions to mask up, because you never know who you could transmit that to, who could become very ill from it.
Thanks so much, Dr. Carlson. All right, we're getting a lot of questions. So let me turn to questions from our listeners. And again, you can submit questions through the Q&A function at the bottom of the Zoom screen. Lizzie writes, I have a 4-month-old infant at home. My family is fully vaccinated, but he goes to daycare. How can we protect him, or what can we do to keep him safe?
Well, I can start, and then I'll ask my colleague to make sure I don't forget any important things. But I think, you know, this is going to be our real challenge, whether we're talking about daycare or schools or whatever. With a 4-month-old, you can't mask them. So what we've been talking about is not necessarily an option. And there is a lot of contact in these settings. So the best things that can be done are actually to understand the measures that the daycare center is taking. Are their staff vaccinated? Are they wearing masks with their contact? Are they screening people to make sure they don't have symptoms? You know, what measures are in place? You know, what's going on with their hand hygiene? Are they doing that? You know, have they, for example, separated the cribs? And then, of course, what's also going to be important, and I think this becomes the sort of the more ethically challenging question, is, you know, what is happening with other individuals who are bringing their children there, and what kind of screening is occurring of, you know, among those? You know, what you don't want to happen is somebody who has symptoms bring in their child, and then the child, you know, is asymptomatic perhaps, and then potentially can spread to other children. And so those are the kinds of questions you ask, is you just really need to understand what the strategy is in the institution where you're taking your child.
I would also say, be sure to limit the people who can be around your child, limit who comes into your home, make sure that you have vaccinated people who are coming into your home around your child, and protect yourself as well. Wear your mask at work, wear your mask when you're out and about, so you can be sure to continue that kind of barrier between the outside world and your child. And just be very cognizant of the vaccination status of those who come in contact with your child as well. Kind of there, and they're, just like Dr. Pearl said, kind of their habits, to the extent you know who's around your child and what they're doing when they're not around your child.
Should families with school-aged children have at-home rapid COVID tests available, you know, that they might use to screen their kids? You know, I know that more of those tests are becoming available over the counter. You know, are they reliable? Is that kind of a good tool for parents to be using this fall?
Yeah, that is a great question. And, you know, I certainly would have answered this differently than I'm going to answer it now. The reality is that it depends on what test you're using and the technology behind the test. So that's the first thing. And what people need to understand is some of those tests are not as good if people are not symptomatic, which is where they're being used a lot of times. Their strength, and they are much more what we call sensitive and specific, is when people are symptomatic. So there are some that are performing better than others, but it's really It's a very confusing area, and I would just say maybe not quite ready for prime time yet, although not necessarily a bad idea. And I may say something totally different next week.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Okay, here's a question from Mike. He says there are billions of unvaccinated people globally. How safe are we really from spread and variants from around the world, even if we in the United States reach 80% plus, you know, an 80% plus vaccination rate in the population?
I sound like a broken record. I keep saying this, but and I look forward to Dr. Pearl's comments on this as well, because any of us who work in public health in the global setting know that what happens globally happens locally. There is nothing that infectious disease doesn't know where the border of a country starts, doesn't know where the border of a state starts. It doesn't know where the border of the county starts. So what happens in India happens here. And we saw that, we see that with the more transmission there is, right? The more we're going to get variants, the more likely it is that a variant will result. That's how variants result. Every time there's transmission, there's a copying of the DNA of the virus. Every time that genome is copied, there's a chance for error. So it's just like a photocopy machine, right? You make the photocopy, you take the photocopy, make another photocopy. There's going to be changes there. And so the more there is transmission, the more we'll have variants. So just like you said, Mike, if there is significant transmission in another world of the another area of the world, then even if we get to a certain state in the United States, we're still going to be potentially impacted by a variant. We see that not only with COVID, but we've been seeing it with tuberculosis for generations. We've seen it with many other diseases, so it's not new. So the only way to stop COVID is to stop the transmission around the world, is to get the world vaccinated. As long as there's transmission, there'll be variants. And as long as there'll be variants, there will be something that will be able to outsmart a vaccine. Viruses are much smarter than we are.
Dr. Pearl, would you like to add to that?
No, I think Dr. Carlson summarized it perfectly. Is, you know, we are at risk of having more and more variants. And, you know, until we get not only our country vaccinated, but the world vaccinated, we're really going to need to get a lot of people vaccinated. You know, and I'll just go back to what I was saying before, is this is highly infectious. You know, so we're talking about, right now we think the vaccination rates are going to have to be much higher than 80%. At least with this variant, because it's so transmissible. And, you know, the analogy to think about is, think about, people have talked about chickenpox, but even if you think about measles, to stop measles transmission, you need to vaccinate about 97% of your population. You know, so this isn't measles, but, you know, it's much more infectious than flu and some of these other things. So we have a lot of work to do. And the variants are, I mean, Dr. Carlson's right. They're smart and they're going to outsmart us. And, you know, we're going to have, we can try and keep up, but our best strategy is going to be vaccinate and then wear masks while we're trying to get everyone vaccinated. So, you know, we talk about this. So, you know, it takes you 10 weeks about to develop adequate antibody in general. Maybe 12. And so you're not protected until that. So if you think about all of the people who have to be vaccinated, it's going to be a period of time where we're going to have to really be wearing masks and protect ourselves while we're just really getting up this immunity that we need.
Thank you. Here's one more question from Mike, and it pertains directly to the UT Southwestern forecast. So I'll put it to Dr. Pearl. You know, he asks, he says, your website has several ominous graphs, one of which shows the hospitalizations now versus the peak in January, and it is expressed as a percentage of the 65 and older group. And he says, you know, it's already at 60% of the January peak. So the hospitalization rate for people 65 and older is already at 60% of the January peak, even though that is the most vaccinated group. So he's wondering how many of the current hospitalizations in that age group are among the small group of unvaccinated seniors, and how many are actually serious breakthrough cases, if you know.
Yeah, I can't give you an exact percentage, but I can give you my impression, which I'm pretty sure is everyone else's impression, because I see these data every day. But I would say about 90% of what is getting admitted is unvaccinated. I mean, this is an epidemic of the unvaccinated. And that's the tragedy out there, is these are young people. These are not the people that I was used to seeing in the early phases of the pandemic. I mean, it is really heartbreaking. And so it's a very different population that we're seeing right now. And that's the tragedy. And these are individuals who, you know, they sort of think that nothing's ever going to hurt them. They're sort of immune from all of this. And it's so it's a different epidemic. But yes, we are seeing some elderly, not in the huge numbers that we were. And what I will also tell you is, as more and more information comes out about the vaccines and boosters, et cetera, what we're going to probably see, because we're beginning to see it, is that the time from your original vaccination may end up being important in how much immunity you have.
Okay, here's a question from Deborah. She says, I have concerns about flying next week as a senior, and it's been 7 months since my second vaccination. With the vaccine effectiveness waning over time, what are your recommendations about flying with this Delta variant? Dr. Carlson, do you want to start with that one?
I'm very careful about the mask I wear, and I realize if you're not in the healthcare profession, you haven't had the benefit of being respirator mask fit tested. But what we look for that is to make sure that the mask fits completely around your face, so there aren't any gaps. So I would make sure that you're wearing a very good mask. With a nose wire, okay, get the nose wire and make sure it covers your face, but so there's no gaps. So a nose wire is really, really helpful. And where, you know, we kind of have the pseudo N95, I call them, that, you know, we can all get. So that's a good option as long as it fits your face well. I see people wearing the big like pseudo N95s and they have like a little face and they have this big mask on that's gapping. That's not so good. So we want to make sure that your mask really fits in your face without a lot of air coming in. Or if you're wearing the cloth double layer mask, make sure it's fits your face well, especially like the clamshell is really well with that, and has a little pocket for a filter. You can put in a filter inside that, and that will also help you. I would also, you know, and again, this is more of a respiratory transmission rather than a touch point, but that doesn't mean we want to get careless with touch points. So personally, even before COVID, I always traveled with my little bag of disinfectant wipes, my little pack, travel pack of those in my carry-on. And I wiped down everything, the tray, I wiped down the seat handles, I wiped out the seat belt, I wiped down everything as soon as I sit down in that seat. So that's another thing you want to be careful of. Also, your phone. Your phone is a petri dish. We touch everything, we touch our phone. So keep your phone wiped down. I carry little alcohol swabs with me that I just quickly wipe off my phone from time to time. Because even if you're really careful, you know, you've gone through airport security, you've now touched things that have people have transmitted germs onto that have come from all over the world. They've touched everybody else's luggage. They've now touched yours. You touch your luggage, you touch your phone to check your flight or get your Uber. Okay, now you've just transmitted all those germs onto your phone. Keep your phone clean. Also, keep your luggage handle clean. If you're carrying on or if you're picking up from baggage claim, just really nicely keep that little alcohol swab or that disinfectant wipe and clean off that luggage handle. So those are some kind of simple things we can do. And honestly, I did a lot of those things even during flu season before we had COVID. So those are simple things we can do to help stop transmission when we travel.
Speaking of masks, Beth Ann has a question about masks. Is there a big difference between N95 and KN95 masks? And is it possible for non-medical individuals to get N95 masks? Dr. Carlson, do you want to take that one since you were just talking about masks?
There is some difference. And because we can't always trust the manufacturing of the K95 is going to be different than what is available to our healthcare workers. That said, let's save the PPE for the healthcare workers, for Dr. Pearl and her team who are on the front lines, and we can get plenty of protection from the K95 or KN95, whatever they're calling them. You know, we can get plenty of protection from that. That's not the difference between a medical grade N95 mask for somebody who's been respirator fit tested and for what, you know, that those are for folks who are literally on the front lines getting fluids in their face. You know, most of us hopefully are not going to have fluids in our face when we're on the airplane, heaven forbid, or, you know, going into the grocery store. We need something that's, you know, not as bulletproof as our frontline healthcare providers need. So for our purposes, this type of like KN95 mask, that is perfectly fine for what we're doing, where we're not having, you know, bodily fluids and people who are directly infectious in our face. We're just trying to keep protected. We're going to the grocery store so we don't get the disease and transmit it to somebody else. So I wouldn't be afraid of just sticking with the KN95. That's perfectly good protection, or your double layer fabric mask, maybe with a little filter in there. That's perfectly fine for what the majority of us are just doing day to day. I would really just stick with that and just make sure you get one that fits your face. And for women, I'll tell you that a lot of those masks out there are kind of big. They're for men's faces, some of them. So make sure that you get the right size. That's something else that you do when you go through the respirator fit test and make sure you get the mask that fits your face. And we can do that just by making sure that we're ordering masks that allow us to select a size. There are some masks that you can order out there that allow you to select a size. And I would go with those for women who have maybe smaller faces.
The only other thing that I would add on is you do need to change these masks. And, you know, so especially if someone's been coughing around you or whatever, just like Dr. Carlson was talking about, they can get contaminated. You know, those also can be a surface that can get contaminated. And then maybe you touch that and then you rub your eye. So, you know, you do want to make sure that you change your masks and that you also, if you're using a cloth mask, that you wash it. So you want to have clean equipment. Sometimes what I do is I wear a little surgical mask on top of my other mask just so I can easily throw that one off. So that's another trick that you can use. And then my other trick, my secret trick for cloth masks is there's actually really interesting data that shows that if you put a layer of nylon stocking, that actually has increased filtration. So if you like cloth masks, just put in an extra layer with a nylon stocking, you know, the one with the run in it. Well, you can now use that and you can line your mask and that'll give you additional filtration.
That's great. Thank you. I wanted to also just ask about boosters. What is the government now recommending about boosters? If it's been 8 months since your second vaccine shot, can you now just go out and make an appointment and get a booster? And, you know, who should get a booster and when?
Yeah, this is a difficult area to navigate right now, because the White House has come out with recommendations before it's gone to the CDC and the FDA. And so not all the data have been vetted as much as we would like. And so if I appear to be trying to swim on top of the water, it's because I am. But anyway, let me just sort of say, first of all, the ACIP, which is the advisory committee to the CDC for immunization, has recommended a booster for immunocompromised individuals with certain conditions. So it's not everything, but some examples are people who are getting immunosuppressants, for example, like you would have if you have an organ transplant. You might be getting some of these drugs if you have certain rheumatologic conditions, if you have advanced HIV. So there's a list on the CDC website of these immunocompromised conditions. And you can go and get your vaccine now. Your provider should be able to write a prescription for that so that you can get it. Ideally, we would like you to get the same vaccine. Now, that recommendation is only if you've gotten mRNA vaccines. We do not know yet, and there is not a recommendation for the J&J vaccine. The next area is there are data in the elderly in congregate settings, which really means nursing homes, long-term care facilities, et cetera. And I would expect that we may get a recommendation relatively quickly on that group. But as I said earlier, it is true that there are other groups where there's evidence that immunity may be waning. And that is, again, a very murky area to navigate because what exactly equals immunity is not as clear as we would like it to be. I would love to sit here and say, if your level is this, you're going to be protected, but I can't right now. So that's the reality of the data. Now, there has been an announcement that they may require or recommend it for anyone who was vaccinated more than 8 months ago. And I think that may be coming down the pike, but I honestly haven't seen the data to be able to comment as thoughtfully as I would like to. And so I think we just have to wait and see what comes out of the FDA as well as the ACIP, which is the group I mentioned that advises the CDC.
I'd like to just piggyback on that with regard to a common question that I think we're hearing a lot in public health, which is the notion that if we're requiring a booster, it meant the vaccine didn't work or it didn't work well. And so I'd just like to clarify a little bit of that for anyone who's having that question or concern. And that is that vaccines to protect us from COVID-19 were tested and developed with the goal of stopping development of severe disease. Not necessarily completely stopping transmission. The vaccines are to keep us alive and to keep us from permanent disability. And so stopping transmission completely was not necessarily the initial goal. So it can't be surprising that we will have some breakthrough infections. That doesn't mean the vaccine doesn't work, because we define work as the vaccine keeps us alive. It keeps us from being hospitalized. It reduces burden on the healthcare system, reducing hospitalizations. And so those things are, it's working very, 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 very well on. It's extraordinarily effective. So the vaccine is working. And so it's kind of like, you know, the flu shot. I think all of us in the past have had a flu shot and then had maybe a mild case of the flu and said, that flu shot worked. Yeah, it worked because you had a mild case instead of a serious case. That's the goal of this. So also we need to keep in mind those folks who are saying, well, there's breakthrough cases. That means it's not working, or should I still get vaccinated? I want us to keep in mind a little bit of simple math here. And that is, as more people get vaccinated, which is a good thing, the proportion of breakthrough cases to normal cases, meaning transmitted by unvaccinated people, will rise because we simply have a higher proportion of vaccinated to unvaccinated people, hopefully. So that's just what I wanted everyone to keep in mind. As we hear more and more about breakthrough cases, it's not necessarily that the immunity is waning a lot. It's not that it's not working. It's that thankfully we have more people vaccinated, and it's natural to have some breakthrough cases with a vaccinated population.
Okay, here's a question that I've been kind of wondering as well. It comes from Becky. We were told originally that a less than 15-minute encounter with an infected individual would not be likely to infect you. With the Delta variant, what is the revised safe timeframe for exposure? Dr. Pearl, would you know the answer to that?
I would not know the answer to that because I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. What we're currently saying is, again, we're using the 15-minute cutoff with face-to-face contact, not wearing PPE. But I think the question, this is virus, you get high level of virus, but for a much shorter period of time. So, and right now, that's the best answer I can give you.
Okay. Here's a question from Mike. Is the booster shot different from the first two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine?
The booster right now is recommended for, you get the same, you should have the same manufacturer for your booster that you had for your original dose. If you get a different manufacturer, do we actually know whether or not it'll work? We don't know as much about the mRNA vaccines. We actually do know that if, for example, you got an mRNA vaccine and then J&J, that you do have a more robust immune response. But those studies are really sort of in evolution right now. And so we're just recommending that you stick with what you got before.
But in terms of the formulation and the dosage, is it the exact same shot that you got the first two times?
Yes.
Okay. And what about, I thought originally Pfizer and Moderna were talking about reformulating their vaccines to better match the mutations in the variants. Is that still something that they're considering? You know, and why are these boosters kind of the same rather than tweaked for variants?
Yeah, it's a great question also. So, you know, the technology to develop these vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, is extraordinary, and it's developed over 20 years, probably. And the beauty of it is that, for example, with this original vaccine, once the structure was released, or the genomic structure was released, it literally took them about 4 days to construct this vaccine. And so it was really cool. But as you all know, it then took almost, 9 months to a year to actually do the clinical trials. So Moderna has reformulated their vaccine. They're doing a clinical trial right now looking at a structure that they think is going to be more active against the variant. They do have data suggesting that the third booster, as well as this reformulated vaccine, are both very active in terms of stimulating the immune system, which is what we want. Pfizer has also started working on this, if they have not worked on it, and they may actually have clinical trials going on. I'm not sure on that one. But, you know, I expect that very much like the flu vaccines, we're going to sort of see, you know, that the next coronavirus vaccine will be coronavirus Delta, Lambda, this, whatever. And then next year, you'll get whatever Greek letter alphabet soup is for what's circulating at the time. So I think that we will see this. But again, it just takes time, and they have to make sure when they test it in people that it generates the appropriate immune responses that they want.
I think that was a really helpful response. I want to kind of piggyback on that again for this FAQ that we're often getting in public health, which is this idea that because there's boosters, then somebody doesn't know what they're doing, right? And what I want everyone to think about who has a question about that is to recall that there's a lot of vaccines out there that are given as a series or as a booster. So think about tetanus, a widely accepted vaccine given as a booster, Tdap given as a booster. And then there's other vaccines that are given as series, Hep B, for instance, MMR. So it's not unusual because COVID is new. It's figuring out, is this going to be a series? Is it going to be a booster? How is this going to look? Is it like a flu shot where there's new strains put in each year? What's this going to look like? So it's not that, it's a very, very good process. It's a very, very good vaccine. And it's that eventually we will know, is this a booster, is this a series? But in the meantime, they're doing everything possible in science to keep people safe while they determine, is this going to be a regular booster or series or what? Because it's not regular yet. COVID is new. So in the meantime, we need to do what we're told according to the best science available and get the boosters when we're told to get the boosters. And eventually we'll know, and it'll be just like tetanus or MMR or anything else. We won't think twice about it.
Okay, here's a concerning question from a middle school parent. Our daughter is in a middle school that doesn't require masks. It's well over 1,000 kids jammed shoulder to shoulder in the hallways and auditoriums. About 30% of the kids wear masks. No faculty wear masks. She wears a KN95 daily. Do you have any more advice for her?
So again, I would just reiterate, part of this is going to be risk behavior and behaviors of those around. And I think we can't highlight enough that we're not going to be able to have a technological solution out of this pandemic. You know, we're, the vaccine alone is not going to solve the pandemic. It's going to be the behaviors plus the vaccine. It's the masks alone won't solve it. You have to wear them. So as much as she can social distance, that she can, be in situations that are lower risk, that's going to protect her more. The second thing is she eligible to get vaccinated? You know, middle school is sort of a wide age range, but just remember, when you're 12 and older, you can get vaccinated. And so this would be a good time to get vaccinated. And then finally, as parents, we can be very strong advocates for our children and very influential in school districts. And I think that, you know, we have to also make sure that our voices are heard about what we think will keep our children safe. So do not at all hesitate to advocate for behaviors that you think are important to keep your child, protected.
Great. Here's one other question about kids. It's from Vincent. He asks, let's look at stats from CDC and COVID tracking. Since COVID started, we've had over 600,000 deaths, but only 400 in the cohort under 18. That's the same order of magnitude as flu for kids. Why should our behavior with kids be so significantly different when, let's face it, kids are insignificantly affected by COVID? The only priority action and messaging should be to get adults vaccinated. How would you respond to that, either one of you?
I would respond to that by saying that truly public health is public health, meaning that it's about the community around us. And I think that's a very fair question, by the way, and I appreciate the question. But that's where we've really struggled, I think, in public health, is to, particularly in the United States and in countries where we have a very individualistic culture, which has served us well in many, many regards. But the way we think is not immediately, how am I going to protect or help somebody else? It's how am I going to protect and help myself? And if I'm pretty bulletproof and not probably going to get very sick, then why does it matter? If a child is not particularly affected by it, why does it matter? And it matters for the larger community. It matters because if that child maybe does not even exhibit symptoms, transmits it to grandma, who's maybe a cancer survivor and of older age, that's a huge problem. And so that's why it matters. It's really not always about the individual who could potentially get ill. It's about who they're going to give it to. And so the only way we really are going to recover from this and get normal daily life back for our kiddos and for everyone is if we are aware of how our actions are affecting others.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's a great question. And it's a complicated question to answer. But the other thing that we've learned about epidemics and transmission of infectious diseases is congregate settings like schools, where you have a lot of social interaction, really can't, or, and hospitals would be another example also, can really be drivers for epidemics and pandemics. And so we know, for example, from influenza, that if you close schools, you actually stop transmission of influenza. And so, you know, a lot of this is that even though the kids aren't getting sick, they are the sources of infection, as Dr. Carlson was explaining, for other individuals, and can actually really fuel a lot of the background and the prevalence, if you will, in the community.
Yes, I love what you just said, Dr. Pearl. From an epidemiological perspective, just like you said, we think about everything as far as a chain of transmission. So those children, even if it's a five-year-old transmitting it to another five-year-old, and neither of them will ever be symptomatic, maybe even, it's still transmission. And so they're still in the chain of transmission, just thus proliferating the disease that then goes on to somebody who will eventually be caught by somebody who will have severe disease from it or worse. Also, transmission is transmission. Whether it's from between 2 5-year-olds or between 2 30-year-olds or whoever, or between 2 healthy people or from a healthy person to a sick person, every time that virus is transmitted, that genome copies, which means another opportunity for a very robust variant to come about. That's the thing. We've got to shut down transmission in all forms if we're going to stop variants from emerging.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that we really learned in this initial wave was how disruptive it was to have schools closed. You know, parents couldn't go to work. Parents were trying to work with their kids doing online teaching. There were mental health issues associated with it. We know that learning wasn't as good. So we really need to try and make this environment as safe as we can. And that includes not only for the kids, but for the teachers and the staff at the schools, et cetera. And so just as Dr. Carlson was talking about the chain of transmission is also almost a key component of economic recovery and sort of social as well as mental health recovery is making the schools, giving them every tool we can potentially give them to be successful.
Great. We have a lot of questions about how long people with COVID are contagious, especially with the Delta variant. How long after exposure to the virus is a person capable of transmitting it? And how long are people staying contagious?
So that's actually a complicated question, but so once you are, so from the time you are exposed until you have, there's 14 days to when you can develop symptoms. With Delta variant, it's actually a little shorter. And so that it may not be 14 days, it may be 13 days, but you know, so you are quarantined, if you will, for 14 days after being exposed. In terms of infection, so you were exposed and say on day 5, you develop symptoms. So now you're infectious. What we do is we will isolate you for 10 days. And after 10 days, unless you're severely immunocompromised, you should not shed virus. That actually may be shorter with Delta, because what we think is they get infectious, they're as infectious, but it appears they're getting infectious earlier. And it just may be, again, a really rapid increase and then a more rapid drop off. We're not 100% sure yet. So 10 days after symptoms develop or you test positive, and 14 days after exposure is the time frame you can develop symptoms.
But you can be contagious even without symptoms, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Vaccinated or not vaccinated, absolutely. And that's been one of the stories of this virus, is that we have people who are not symptomatic who transmit.
Okay, here's another family gathering question. Kelly writes, my father is 93 and was fully vaccinated in early January. We meet as a family, all vaccinated, for brunch on Sundays. With what we know now about decreasing efficacy of vaccines over time, should we stop this practice until he can get a booster?
You know, that's one of those you have to do a risk assessment. You know, what were people doing? Are people out at, you know, at the state fair not wearing a mask who are vaccinated? I mean, what's really the risk? Or is it, say, his wife who doesn't go out anymore? I mean, who's just isolated with him? The risk is probably pretty low. So you have to do a risk assessment is one thing. But let's assume that people are out and about and maybe not as following precautions as much as they should. They should at least be wearing masks when they get together. I don't know. What do you think, Dr. Carlson?
I was going to say the same thing if I had to take that question, which is everything happens on a continuum of risk, you know, and I really appreciated that question because I'm facing the same thing right now with my parents, particularly my father in his mid-80s, and facing the same kind of question. And it really is a continuum of risk, and how safe is everybody who's around him? And also, what does it do to my parents' mental health if they're completely isolated? And so what's the risk benefit analysis here?
All right. Thank you so much. Our time is pretty much up, and I just wanted to thank you both for joining us. Do either of you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share before we let you get back to your busy days?
Well, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Carlson. It's been totally fun. I also want to basically say that this is a wonderful vaccine. Everyone should go out and get vaccinated. If you're not fully vaccinated, please get vaccinated. And also, please wear your masks. I think it's really our only way out of this. And, you know, it's just really the best information and advice we can give you is it's a changing situation. And these are small things that we're asking everyone as a community to do so that we can get back to all of those things we love doing.
It has been a joy to be here. I echo Dr. Pearl just said, thank you for this opportunity. And it's been so fun to be on this panel and to get to be here with Dr. Pearl as well. So thank you. I just want to end by saying, first of all, 90% of Americans have a vaccine site within 5 miles of where they live now. Okay, we all have access in the United States, and we are very fortunate to have that. And I hope we take advantage of it. Many of our brothers and sisters around the world and other countries don't have access to the vaccine and want it so much. And we have it. And yet there's people who are choosing not to get it. We do have access. And then I'd like to end with a story. It's a true story. And it's a story of two families I know. And this happened this summer, shortly after Delta started becoming prevalent in Texas. And in each of these two families, there was the father. They actually have the same first name, in fact. They're the same age, and they both have very similar families and occupations and all of this. And during the same week, each of the families became infected with COVID-19, actually both from church camp, from a similar source even. And both families became very ill. The one family had been fully vaccinated, and they recovered after about a week. They had some symptoms, and then they recovered. And life is back to everything as usual. The other family, which became very ill, their father died. And their mother was sick for a very long time. The course of their family is forever changed. They hadn't been vaccinated yet. And so vaccines can absolutely change the course of our life for better or for worse. So let's make sure that we leverage every opportunity we can so we can take advantage of the blip in the radar that this can be if we get it, if we're fully vaccinated compared to if we're not.
Thank you so much. So I want to thank Dr. Erin Carlson, Director of Graduate Programs at UT Arlington's College of Nursing and Health Innovation, and Dr. Trish Pearl, who's Chief of Infectious Diseases at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Thanks so much to both of you for taking the time to join us today. Thank you to everyone who listened, and especially to our subscribers for supporting the Dallas Morning News. Thank you.